And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and now I have the pleasure of introducing you to Dr. Heather Lynch, who is a quantitative ecologist and associate professor at Stony Brook University. Thank you for being a part of This Green Earth today.
Of course, it's my pleasure. I'm really excited to be here.
So let's start with quantitative ecologist. What does that mean?
You know, I think most people are kind of familiar with this idea of an ecologist, and you probably think an ecologist is someone who's got their boots on and they're out in the forest and they're measuring trees. And we do a lot of field work in my lab, but a quantitative ecologist is someone who comes at this from the perspective of mathematics and modeling. And I get really excited about data and numbers. And so the bulk of my research is really trying to crunch the numbers to figure out how many penguins there are in Antarctica, and how their populations are changing through time and what we might expect for the future. But a lot of that is coming from models rather than just from the data itself. And that's where the quantitative ecologist comes in.
And I even see behind you that you have a painting of penguins. When did this curiosity about this specific species on our planet really ignite in you?
Well, it's funny. Initially, I was in a lab for physics. I actually transferred from physics to biology in my fourth year of graduate school, which is insanely late to decide that you finally figured out what you want to do. My expertise was really in pulling together historical data sets that were perhaps collected for other reasons. And I wanted to work at the University of Maryland with a professor called Bill Fagan. And he just happened to have a brand new collaboration and a bunch of penguin data that I could work on. And I was really excited about this because penguins are really cool, but also because this was a really complicated data set. I joked that only a mother could love. It really needed a lot of curation and care. And so I took that on as a challenge and really spent about 2 years trying to reconstruct what we know about penguins in Antarctica. And so that sort of kick-started my journey, but it very much came from a love of numbers rather than a love of penguins. Of course, I love penguins now, but they're an acquired taste.
You have grown an affinity towards them. Well, there's a lot to love about penguins. We actually had Matthew Boyer, who is a researcher at the University of Helsinki, on not too long ago, talking about the potential impacts of penguin poop or guano on climate change. And this is something that you're also studying, and you have different methods in which to do this and very interesting ways where you are bringing technology in to study these penguins. So can you tell us the particular areas in which you are studying, where they are located, what types of penguins they are, and then we'll get into these methods?
Sure. So my fieldwork is very much focused on the Antarctic Peninsula. So it is by far the most temperate, mild part of Antarctica. And the temperatures in the summer on the Antarctic Peninsula are what we would expect in the winter here in the United States. So it's not the kind of bone-chilling, extraterrestrial kind of level cold that you would expect of Antarctica. But that is where most of Antarctic's terrestrial biodiversity lives. And so on the Antarctic Peninsula are a group of penguins that we call the brush-tailed penguins, the chinstrap penguin, the gentoo penguin, and the Adélie penguin, that are all very closely related. And those are the three species that I particularly focus on. And then there's a couple of other species that are moving into the Antarctic because the Antarctic is getting warmer under climate change, and we're tracking those as well. But those three brush-tailed penguin species are the ones that are sort of the bread and butter of our fieldwork on the peninsula.
When you define this particular type of penguin, what are some of the biological things that either set them apart or there are particularly interesting about this species?
Sure. So these are, you know, for what it's worth, also species that you can see in zoos and aquaria. The gentoo penguin in particular is very common. If you were to go to your local aquarium and they have penguins, they probably have gentoo penguins. But all three species are very similar in size, somewhere between a large cat and a small dog. They lay two eggs. They breed at exactly the same time. They build nests out of pebbles and rocks. They breed right on the land. And they eat a very similar diet, so not exactly the same. And some of these subtle shifts in diet are among the things that we're studying. But for the most part, they're eating something called Antarctic krill on the Antarctic Peninsula, which is, it looks like a small shrimp. And so, you know, other than the fact that they visually look different from a natural history perspective, they live very similar lives and have very similar requirements down on the peninsula.
Yeah, so you have now taken to the skies, really, to understand what's happening with them on the land. So describe to me the satellite imagery that you're now utilizing and what you're detecting from it and what sets this technology apart from past ways in which we were studying the penguins.
When I started working on penguins, I had already been thinking about ways in which we could use satellite imagery to study animal dynamics. And it turns out that penguins, they nest in very particular locations. They're very site faithful, and they nest in these big groups called colonies. And even though we can't quite see individual penguins from satellite imagery, we can see the guano stain, or the stain of excrement that these colonies form over the course of the breeding season. So you can imagine a penguin that's sitting on a nest. It can't move from its nest. And over time, the excrement from that penguin forms a sundial pattern, almost like you would get at the county fair when you drip paint on a spinning disc and it makes these elaborate sort of paintings. Mm. That's exactly what the penguins are doing. And then combine that with all of its hundreds or thousands and thousands of neighbors, and what you get is this pink pool of guano that is large enough that we can map it out from space. And this has totally and completely radically changed the way we can study penguins in Antarctica. Because before satellites, you cannot systematically search the entire coastline of Antarctica for penguins. And so what we had were these sort of scattered reports of from either expeditions that would say, hey, it's about 1,000 penguins on this rock, or maybe 10,000 on that rock. But most of Antarctica was like terra incognita. Like, we just did not know what we did not know in terms of the distribution of penguins. So as soon as you can start looking for penguin colonies from satellite imagery, the whole world opens up, because now you can actually find all the penguin colonies in Antarctica, and you know where they're not breeding. And so for the first time, we could actually just catalog where are all the penguin colonies in Antarctica, and we could start tracking them through time. So it's like night and day between what we were doing before and what we're able to do now with satellites.
And how are the populations doing, and what effect are penguins having on their ecosystems?
Yes, we are interested in sort of both directions of this story. Like, how is the changing climate influencing penguin populations? Mm-hmm. On the Antarctic Peninsula, the story is actually quite clear. What we have is one species that we call a big climate change winner, and that's the Gentoo penguin. And the Gentoo penguin is absolutely happy as a clam that the Antarctic is getting warmer and it's getting wetter. And from the Gentoo penguin's perspective, this is looking a lot more like home for the Gentoo penguin. And Gentoo penguin populations have skyrocketed, and Gentoos are actually moving further south, in further into the Antarctic, into areas that previously had been too cold for them. But the other two species, the chinstrap and the Adelie penguin, their populations have declined markedly, you know, in some cases by 80 or 90% at some of these colonies. And so we've seen a massive collapse of two species and then the rise of a third species. At the continental scale, the rest of Antarctica has been slower to warm. And in some cases, we've seen either cooling, or we've seen areas where the ice is actually getting more extensive. So we really have to separate out the peninsula, where it's getting hotter, and the populations are changing in ways that we now understand really well, and the rest of the Antarctic continent, where climate change is happening, but it's quite a bit more complicated. And Adelie penguins, we think that they're generally sort of growing or stable over the rest of the Antarctic continent. Now we can ask ourselves, well, what are penguins doing to the climate? And I know that that's something that other researchers are quite interested in. My own work has really only looked at this from the perspective of what penguin guano can do for the plants. We don't think of plants as being a central part of Antarctic biodiversity, but there are some plants and mosses that make a living, sort of scrape out an existence in the Antarctic. And the Antarctic is a very nutrient poor place. And so one of the things that seabirds do is they take nutrients from the ocean, they eat fish in the ocean, they clamber up on land, and then they poop out all those nutrients on land. And so they're like a conveyor belt for nutrients, moving nutrients from the ocean to the land. And they can have a really important impact in essentially fertilizing the vegetation of the Antarctic around these colonies. And so we certainly see that as an impact. And so where populations are disappearing, that's going to have a negative impact on the vegetation. And where populations are increasing, we might expect that it would have at least locally a positive benefit on the vegetation. So very interesting problem, because the penguins are impacting the environment, and certainly the environment is shaping penguins as well.
Right. When you have the Gentoos coming in and having a greater existence. And then you have these other two species who are struggling a little bit due to climate change. What does that do to an ecosystem? What shifts are you seeing in maybe the vegetation or what is happening there, even with krill?
Oh, it's a great question, and one of the things that we're still trying to understand. I would say, to first order, a penguin is a penguin is a penguin, which is to say that if we were to lose an Adelie penguin in this ecosystem and gain a Gentoo penguin, to first approximation, it's kind of neutral with regard to the environment. The Gentoo and the Adelie are probably eating roughly similar amounts of krill in the environment. They're roughly pooping out the same amount of guano on land. By and large, in terms of their ecosystem role, these Pygocelid penguins are probably pretty interchangeable. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in what is the total number of penguins in this area doing? And there, what we're seeing is that we're losing more Adelies and chinstraps than we are gaining Gentoos. So even though the Gentoo populations are growing and growing, Gentoo populations in general are just much, much smaller than these other two. So we're losing these two very numerous dominant species. And while we're seeing gains in this third species, it's not making up for it. So we're definitely losing penguins on the Antarctic Peninsula overall. And so we would expect maybe a slowing of this conveyor belt of nutrients to the land. And then, although these penguins are eating krill, just about everything in the Antarctic eats krill. And so they probably have a pretty minor impact on the krill populations compared to the seals and the whales. And so when we look at how much krill is in the ocean, we might see major changes in the number of penguins, but from the krill's perspective, all they care about is how many whales and seals there are. And so the penguins are probably a pretty minor, there's a lot of them, but they don't eat as much. And so even just adding one whale to the ecosystem is going to offset a whole bunch of losses that we might be seeing on the penguins.
What about human impact in the krill population?
So we impact the krill populations in a number of ways. One is just through climate change, because the climate is changing and that's having an impact on the krill abundances. But we also have a really direct impact on krill because we eat krill. And that's something that a lot of people don't realize, that they might be eating krill. So krill are used as feed for farm-raised salmon in particular, so for aquaculture. But they're also used as a alternative to fish oil supplements. And so many people might be taking a krill oil supplement, and those will be coming from the Antarctic. And so, for example, if you look at the bottle when you go to the store, particularly the brand that they sell at Costco, and you flip it to the back, it'll have a map of the Antarctic, and it will show you where in the ocean that krill was caught that ended up in that bottle that you're holding. And so it's a tightly regulated industry, and there's a lot of traceability in principle. I think there's still some concerns that these krill boats are becoming so efficient at sucking krill out of the ocean that it might deplete the amount that's available to the penguins nearby. And that's something that people like myself worry a lot about. But yeah, we are having a big impact on the krill, and that fishery is certainly not going away because of the popularity of both supplements and the need for feed for aquaculture.
And when humans get involved in conservation, what does that look like? And what are areas in the Southern Ocean that you find to be critical for protection to ensure that penguins can exist?
Yeah, so the Antarctic is managed by the Antarctic Treaty, which is probably a document most people have thought very little about, but it's considered one of the most successful international sort of negotiated treaties that we have. And what the Antarctic Treaty does, it does a lot of things, but it means that the countries, they have to set aside their territorial claims and they have to work cooperatively to manage Antarctica's resources. And that includes resources in the ocean like krill. But it also means that they have to cooperatively manage terrestrial sites that tourists might visit, that research might involve. So the Antarctic Treaty parties meet every year and they, you know, discuss how all of these impacts should be managed. And one of the things that the Antarctic Treaty parties are very focused on is the impacts of tourists, for example. And so a lot of my research is spent trying to figure out what impact do humans have on the penguins that are visited by tourists? Are we having a negative impact? How do we visit them sustainably and responsibly? And so the Antarctic Treaty is sort of the mechanism by which we can make sure that our activities in the Antarctic are sustainable. Now, one of the things that the treaty parties have under their sleeves is what are called Antarctic Specially Managed Areas, or Antarctic Specially Protected Areas. And these are a little bit like the national parks of the Antarctic, which is that they can set aside areas that are particularly important to protect, either because they have huge numbers of penguins or because maybe there's an important moss species that lives here or for any reason. And so some of the work that we do with penguins allows us to identify where we might have huge aggregations of penguins that are worthy of protection in that way. And one of our biggest sort of successes with this satellite imagery was identifying a huge population of Adélie penguins in a place called the Danger Islands. Now, the Danger Islands are so tiny that they don't even appear on, most maps of the Antarctic. It's only about, 15 miles from one end to the other. It's this tiny archipelago of islands in an area that's dense with sea ice, and yet it holds more Adélie penguins than the rest of the Antarctic Peninsula combined. And so we discovered this huge population of penguins in this area about 10 years ago, and then organized an expedition to the region to confirm and to do drone imagery and to map it out and count everything. And as a result, the Danger Islands have been protected as an Antarctic Specially Protected Area, and it's been proposed that one of the marine protected areas in the region will be expanded to include it. And so that's a really nice example of where we can discover something as scientists, and that actually translates into the establishment of a protected area in a region that we now know hosts continentally important populations of penguins.
And do you look at these penguins and what they're doing and how they're surviving in a changing climate and a changing world and utilize that to overall look at the health of this area?
Yeah, so we think of penguins as being, the canaries in the coal mine of Antarctica. And part of the focus on penguins is because krill themselves are so difficult to study. So almost everything in this region eats krill or eats something that eats krill. And if we had, superpowers as scientists, we would just count all the krill. And in some ways, the krill would be the only thing we'd need to count because they're so important to the rest of the food chain. But krill are incredibly difficult to survey, not only because they're in the ocean, but because they aggregate together in these vast swarms that sort of move, from our perspective, somewhat unpredictably through the water column. And it's just hard to know how many krill there are in the environment. So what we do instead is we monitor the things that are eating the krill as sort of a proxy for how the krill are doing. And penguins are one of those species. And penguins are particularly useful in this way because they do return to the same locations year after year. And so we don't have to go hunting for them. We know exactly where they're going to be. We sail our boat right up to that colony. That colony is going to be exactly the same penguins, plus or minus offspring, that were there the year before. And so we can count all the penguins on this island through time and see how the populations are changing. And then we try and link those changes to changes in the environment, due to things like climate change. So that's one of the ways in which we can assess the health of the Southern Ocean is by tracking the populations of penguins. But what's really cool is that, let's say in the old days, we could count penguins. And so we would say, oh, well, there were, 17,000 this year and 16,500 the next year and so forth. We would just have a number and we would be tracking that number through time. But with satellite imagery, it's like you're in space, you're taking a photograph down on the colony. And we can look at the shapes that these penguin colonies take. And it turns out that the shapes these penguin colonies take, they take a variety of different shapes. And that shape is telling us something about the health of the colony in terms of whether the population is growing or shrinking. And so we have colonies that will take these like complex labyrinthine patterns. Sometimes they'll take spotted patterns or they'll form striped patterns. And so we can track their numbers through time, but we can also see how their shapes are changing through time. And those are both giving us information on whether the population is growing or shrinking. And if they're shrinking, obviously that's something that concerns us, and we want to know why they're shrinking and whether that's related to the climate or whether it's related to krill fishing or maybe it's related to tourism itself.
Interesting. So, when you look at these shapes and you're studying these different colonies, is there a hierarchy to penguins and how does that work?
So penguins are essentially, they're all lone wolves. They don't have a social organization the way we might think of in other animals. There isn't sort of like an alpha penguin and an omega penguin. As they age, They do start to arrive at the colony a little bit earlier. They might be more competitive at competing for the best nesting sites. But by and large, these penguins are they're existing in their own little bubble, you know, the male and the female penguin on their nest with their chicks, but they interact surprisingly little with their neighbors. They do get annoyed at one another. We've done quite a bit of work with cameras in the colony to understand penguins are constantly stealing stones from one another for nesting material. And so we wanted to know whether penguins seem to recognize one another. So, like if a penguin steals a stone from someone's nest and that same penguin returns, does the penguin on the nest recognize that that was Bob? Bob just stole a stone from me and now I'm going to be annoyed at Bob because I know that Bob's, you know, causing trouble. And it does appear that they can recognize one another, at least at that level. But otherwise, they don't have that kind of social organization that we would see in a lot of other animals.
When you said that you went in for data and you found yourself endeared to these animals, what was it about them that endeared you the most?
I really admire how tough they are. And this is something, a lesson I learned literally my first moments in the Antarctic. I pulled up to shore to my first Antarctic penguin colony on a US research vessel, and I was with a much more experienced researcher next to me. And I saw a chinstrap penguin jump off the cliff and land on its head on the end of like a spiky rock and like roll into the ocean. And I think I said out loud, I was like, oh my God, the first penguin I've ever seen in the wild ever has just died before my eyes. Like it just head first into that rock. And the researcher next to me was like, yeah, it'll be fine. And like, sure enough, I see that the chin strap sort of pop up and shake its head and swim off.
Wow.
And it was an early lesson in just how unbelievably tough and rugged these birds are. They are not smart in any way. They're really pretty dumb, but they are so tough and so rugged. And I just kind of really appreciate how they can take a licking and keep on ticking. And I think that serves them well in the Antarctic. I mean, they live a pretty harsh and challenging life, and they just keep at it year after year.
So, what is it about their exterior, their fins, that allows them to swim the way they do or to have that resilience? What is it about their body functions?
They are all muscle. So we have done quite a bit of genetics where we've been drawing blood. I have a student that's been very focused on Gentoo penguin genetics. So to do that, you know, we have to capture the bird, you know, we have to pick up the bird up and hold it quite tightly while the other person is drawing blood. And the analogy that I've come to is it's like you're hugging the thigh of Usain Bolt, like the sprinter. You just imagine what it's like to hug a sprinter's thigh. I mean, that's what a penguin is like. They are all muscle. There is no fat on these birds. They're not soft or squishy or delicate. They're like a tube of ripped muscle underneath all those feathers, and they're just so strong. It's really remarkable how strong they are, and that allows them to swim quickly and deep and far and to withstand sort of the knocks and blows that come from, you know, jumping in and out of the water and rough surf conditions. And they are much stronger and more muscular than I think is evident from seeing them from the outside with all of those feathers.
And what is their vision like?
So they are visual predators. Their vision is quite good. You know, they see individual krill and they're going after them in the water. So it's not like they're filter feeding like a big whale where it just sort of opens its mouth. Yeah, their visual system appears you know quite good, although like a lot of wild animals actually getting at the details of things like vision and smell is a challenge.
Yeah, and how do they pick a mate? Have you watched how they observe and decide how to mate up?
This is something that we've been trying for a long time to understand, and in particular, we wanted to use captive populations to see what goes into mate choice. Although it turns out that that's just difficult for a lot of reasons. Penguins have mostly arranged marriages in a captive context, so they're not doing a lot of choosing. But in a wild context, penguins are quite mate faithful. They will divorce, but I like to say that they do a bit better than we do in terms of marriage longevity. But how they pick that first mate, you know, I don't know for sure. Certainly, the females are looking for a male that's managed to build a big nest, who looks sort of healthy, who's, you know, calling. But I also think they probably don't have a lot of choice. Adelie penguins are returning to the same site where they were born. And so, in some sense, they're limited to the unpartnered males that are available when they show up at the colony. So, my sense is that they're probably not incredibly picky. They do not have much time to find a mate and settle down once the summer begins, because the Antarctic summer is so short that they really only have a couple of days to mate up and start building, tweaking the nest and to start laying those eggs. So, it's not a particularly protracted process.
And is it true that they do mourn if they lose a chick, that there is a mourning period?
I have certainly seen penguins that have, for example, lost an egg, who have tried to steal an egg from another nest, or have tried to steal an egg that somehow rolled out of one nest and was sort of between nests. I saw a penguin once miscarry an egg. It laid an egg that was all folded up, like it wasn't structurally sound, and then it was trying to steal an egg from another penguin. So I'm not sure that we could say that they mourn in quite the way that we know that elephants do and great apes do, but they have a compulsion to incubate, and this will cause them to steal an egg to incubate if they have to. And I've actually very sadly, in fact, seen a chinstrap penguin incubating a 20-ounce plastic bottle that washed up. I don't know
Oh.
how it carried it into the nest, but I think that their desire to incubate is almost more of a compulsion than it is what we would think of as love.
Well, it's also interesting. They're such an interesting animal, and we appreciate you for all of your research. National Geographic explorer Dr. Heather Lynch, who's a quantitative ecologist and an associate professor at Stony Brook University. And you are going to be right here with Park City Institute. And that is going to be happening on April 24th at 7 p.m. at the Eccles. And so you can hear more from Dr. Heather Lynch.
Of course, I'm looking forward to it. And I will say that if anyone's ever wondered what a penguin colony smells like, I will be bringing my custom-made penguin colony perfume with me to the show. So you can get a sense for what a penguin colony smells like if you come to the show.
Excellent. This is so exciting. I'm so happy for our community that we can welcome you into it.
I'm looking forward to it.